One of the first cars I ever owned was a Morris 1000. It was a Morris 1000 Traveller. And it was unlike the cars that you get today, because it doesn't have, I don't think there was a computer on it. As far as I know, there wasn't any computer on it anyway. But it had an ordinary carburettor and had ordinary timing and spark plugs and everything else. But it was working well, and then it decided to die a little bit on me whenever I put my foot down. Going up a hill or something and put my foot down on it, it would splutter and gurgle its way up the top of the hill. It didn't actually die completely, it kept going, but it wouldn't accelerate properly. There was something wrong. And so I changed all the spark plugs and put new spark plugs in. That didn't make a blind bit of difference at all. I went and checked on the fuel because I thought, well, the fuel must have some water or something in it, and therefore I drained part of the petrol tank at the back. There was a drain plug on the petrol tank. I drained some of the fuel off, or water off if there was any water in there. That didn't do any good at all. I looked at the carburetor. I took the carburetor out. I took it apart. I cleaned all the float chamber out. I got all the jets. I put new jets in. That didn't do anything at all. It just carried on spluttering and gurgling away. And then somebody said, have you checked the air filter? And I'd never even looked at the air filter. So I looked at the air filter, and that was blocked up. And I changed the air filter, and it went like a dream. That was all it was. It was the air filter who happened to be dirty. And I remember at college, Mr. McNair had a Jaguar. And that used to go along for a while, for maybe a month or 2 months, and then start to throw some problems. And what the mechanic used to do at the college was he would just go on the motorway for about an hour up the motorway and an hour down the motorway, and it would fix it for another 2 months. And basically the reason was because this Jaguar was going about a half a mile between Mr. McNair's house and the college and back again every single day, or maybe two or three times a day, and it never ever got warmed up. It never actually got any air blowing its way through the piston, the pots in the head. And it's true of our bodies as well. I mean, we can go ahead and have all kinds of fads about our food and what we're going to be eating and what we're going to be putting in there. We thought, well, we must have our mental state right, and our mental state and the spark about us has got to be put right. And all these things are very good. All these things are worthwhile. They might think, well, what I need is a tonic. And therefore, we go out and we buy these expensive tonics that we consume with gusto. And all we really need, in many cases, is the air to start moving. The air to actually be, the blood to start moving, the exercise necessary to start the blood and the air moving in our bodies. Because, quite frankly, you can go ahead and you can have all the right food. You can have the mental, absolute mental state that you need. You can have all the various aspects and elements of your health perfect. But you don't get any breath, and you last about a minute or 2 minutes or whatever, however minutes it is. You're basically dead in short order, very, very quickly. Breath is essential to life. And today what I want to do in this final series of sermons on health and healing is I want to deal with that area amongst other areas as well, which are related. We talked about healing being the forgiveness of sin, as opposed to what happens in the world so often is they try and avoid the penalty. And that was a key area that we need to keep in mind, particularly as we approach the Passover. And hopefully I'll get this particular series of sermons finished today. In fact, I've got to finish it today. We've only got three or four weeks to the Passover. But the physical repentance certainly is important, that we do look at the subject of physical repentance, because we'll be taking that bread at the Passover. And physical repentance is a good deal more than just trying to find the specific thing that we happen to be doing. It's a total overall way of life. It's a holistic thing. It's a holistic subject. We need to be living a totally healthy, well, not totally, but changing our mental attitude totally towards a healthy lifestyle. We're never going to get it right completely. But our attitude of mind needs to be changed towards a healthy lifestyle. And having that attitude of mind changed, our mind in a tranquil state helps our gut, it helps our heart, it helps our bones, as I went into. And, of course, the food as well. Again, we're not going to get it perfect, because this world is geared in the way of get. It's geared in a consumer. We're making all the people that are eating anything today as consumers. They're part of the industrialized process. And I went into that. But today what I want to do is I want to first of all deal with the subject of breathing. Because without that breath, all getting the food right, getting the mental state right, it's not going to work. It's not going to work at all. And linked to that subject of breathing, I want to talk about exercise. Because exercise helps to get the blood moving, helps to get the breath moving again. It's like that Jaguar car that would only go half a mile every day. Eventually, after a month or 2 months, it just doesn't work. It needs to go up the motorway and do what Jaguars do, roar up the motorway about 140 miles an hour. Before there was a... I remember going in that car at 140 miles an hour. That was before there was a speed limit. The speed limit over here now is 70, but that would do. We were doing 140 going back from Birmingham one time. I'd taken a Cortina up there and broken down up in Birmingham. The car was left there, and they went and picked me up and brought me back down. And they happened to bring the Jaguar, and doing 140, and you're just like standing still. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that. But anyway, breathing, exercise. Sleep is the third thing I want to deal with, and relaxation, which is related to sleep, because Sabbath day, this particular day that we keep today, is to do with rest and relaxation. And the last two points I want to deal with are hygiene and quarantine, because those two areas as well, we find a good deal within Scripture regarding the two areas as well. So those are the areas I want to go into today as the final sermon on this series on health and healing, and hopefully we'll get through all the bits and pieces I'd like to get through. Turn over to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. Here in Genesis chapter 2, and in verse 7, it says, "And the Eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground." So here he was the dust of the ground, the dirt of the ground. "Breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." It's a fundamental. Our life, it consists of the breath that we have. Without that breath, without that physical breath that we have, we don't have a life. The spirit in man, yes, the spirit returns to God who gave it. But the life itself, the life that we have, turn over to Genesis 9. Genesis 9. It says in verse 4, it says, "But verse 3, it says, every moving thing that lives will be food for you, even as a green herb have I given you all things." And modified by the surrounding verses regarding clean and unclean. But it says in verse 4, it says, "But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat." So the life was actually known to be in the blood at the time of Noah. And that is, you can put in your notes Leviticus 3. Well, you turn over to Leviticus, certainly. You turn over to Leviticus 17. But if you put in your notes Leviticus 3, verse 17, it talks about eating neither fat nor blood. And quite frankly, that life that is in the blood, the circulation, the oxygen that comes in from the air that we breathe, is then circulated around the body and feeds all the cells in the body through the blood. So the oxygenation is coming in through the air that we breathe, goes in through the lungs, through the arteries that are in the lungs. It is the arteries, isn't it? And then it basically goes from there into the blood and is then pumped out across the body. But here in Leviticus chapter 17, let's pick it up in verse 11. It says, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood." Our life is in our blood. "The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls. For it's the blood that makes an atonement for the soul." Now, Christ's blood makes an atonement. And that was his physical life. He gave his life so that we can have eternal life. Now, the blood, when that spear went in, and basically out came blood and water, and he died, that blood makes an atonement. And that is because that was his life. The life that was in, it was going around his body, was coming from that blood that he had. Therefore I say to the children of Israel, no soul of you shall eat blood, neither shall a stranger that sojourns among you eat blood. And whatever man there is, the children of Israel, or the strangers that sojourn among you, which hunts and catches any beast or fowl, that it may be eaten, he shall even pour out the blood thereof, and cover it with dust. So those of you that shoot and hunt, you've got to be careful. You make sure that the shot goes in such a way that it doesn't stop the heart dead, but it bleeds into the lung, presumably, and allows that, because you know, you're not going to be able to shoot somebody, say a deer, across the throat, or you'll be able to get there quick enough to be able to cut the throat and bleed it properly, because we shouldn't be eating blood. For it is the life of all flesh. Now, you and I are flesh. All flesh have the life in the blood. That's where our life comes from. That's where Christ's life came from. It came from the blood that was pumping around his veins and arteries. And if we're looking at our life, as I say, you can go ahead and do all the various bits and pieces that you like as far as food is concerned, about mental attitude and frame of mind and everything else. And if there isn't a breath of life in there, you're dead. We're dead. That breath of life is vital. It's the life of all flesh, for the blood is the life thereof. Therefore I say to the children of Israel, you shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh, for the life of all flesh is the blood thereof. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. And it's a reminder that what was coming as far as the sacrifice is concerned, the sacrifice of Christ, and that blood was shed for our life, and that's the symbolism that is there. Now it's interesting that there's different ways of getting the blood moving, but breathing is essential. I know as far as Mr. Armstrong was concerned, he used to get a rub down. One thing he used to do, I remember Mr. Ted Armstrong getting up there and commenting on his father after he'd had a shower. He said he'd just about rub himself pink all over. Literally, you know, I know I'd read about this in the autobiography, I think it was, where he said that one way of getting the blood going was to, I read an article, like it was, sometimes, saying that the ones that achieved the age of 90 or late 80s or 90 with long life, the only thing that they could find that was a commonality throughout the entire group was the fact that they had a daily rub down. And he took that with vigour, and that's what he used to do. He used to get the blood moving, into the outer parts of his body with a daily rub down after a shower. And Mr. Ted Armstrong said he really did that. He really made himself pink, literally, at the end of the shower. But it's interesting that when Christ was already resurrected, and he went to see his disciples, his apostles, and he went towards them and he blew on them, and he said, "Receive the Spirit of God. Receive you the Holy Spirit." He breathed on them. So the breath is likened to the Spirit. And another thing that we need to understand is that the Holy Spirit is something which is active. It's got to be flowing. It's got to be moving. And the air that is actually in that motion, the Spirit that is in that motion, has got to be used. It goes into, you know, we breathe it. The Spirit of God flows into us, and it is then used in our life. It flows out of us in the way we act, in the way we understand things, in the Bible study we do, with the things that we do interacting with each other daily. It's got to be used. And if it's not used, then we quench the Spirit. And it's exactly the same thing with our breath. If we breathe and it's not used, then there are problems. There's problems with over-breathing. When I say problems, I really do mean problems. Let me just read you something. This is coming from Stress Survival. It says on page 127, about the subject of breathing, it says, "Oxygen is the basic stuff of life. Each cell of the body relies on it for fuel. Most of the time, we're not conscious of the fact that we are breathing. Yet during a single day, we take between 16,000 and 23,000 breaths." I never knew that, but okay. Each breath uses up about 250 millilitres of oxygen and disposes of about 200 millilitres of carbon dioxide. And for us to feel relaxed and well, the balance of these two substances is all important. The carbon dioxide to oxygen balance. Under normal circumstances, we cannot regulate the amount of oxygen in the air we breathe, but we can regulate the level of oxygen and carbon dioxide within the body by changing the way we breathe. Normally, our breathing is controlled by the parts of the brain that monitor the ratio of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the body. We exhale as soon as the level of carbon dioxide in the blood makes it more acid. Fast or very deep breathing, known as hyperventilation or overbreathing, causes the body to eliminate too much carbon dioxide. Now, that's important. This may make the blood too alkaline, producing unpleasant side effects. Now, some of those side effects, you might think, well, okay, because he mentions here, he says things like dizziness and cutting off supplies of carbon dioxide to the brain. Forced unnatural styles and rhythms of breathing can therefore upset the finely tuned feedback mechanism that controls our oxygen intake and carbon dioxide output. Shallow, irregular breathing, which can be caused by illness following the respiratory tract, faulty posture or physical tension, also upsets the balance. Now, it means something as far as I'm concerned, because back in the early 90s, I had a problem with this. And I wasn't the only one. There were several ministers at the time. It was the time when all these problems were coming in on the church. And I remember talking to somebody afterwards, after I ended up in hospital with heart fibrillation. And I ended up in hospital with the heart fibrillation, and at the same time, there were other ministers as well, ending up with all kinds of different problems. And it was all to do with overbreathing. And I said, well, I don't overbreathe. And I remember talking to a doctor in the church. And I said, well, I don't overbreathe. He says, you're doing it now. So as I was talking to him, I was actually hyperventilating. And I was talking to him about the problems and difficulties I was actually facing. But it did. I went for a run one day and came back, and my heart was haywire. It was beating in an erratic way. And it was coming from this overbreathing. And I remember reading at the time when I was researching the subject, there was an instance that really sticks in my mind of this girl who was a show jumper and incredibly fit, in her early 20s, and no health problems whatsoever. Her heart was perfectly all right, and her horse fell, broke a leg, and I think I got the feeling that she had to be put down. And she was so distraught with this, she was sitting on the sidelines watching this, she began overbreathing, and it killed her. She literally dropped down dead with a heart attack. And as I say, you get the balance of carbon dioxide out of balance completely in our bodies, and it will actually affect. What it does is the flight or fight mentality. You know, if you want to do something, you start over. The reason why you hyperventilate is that you're pumping all this oxygen in, your carbon dioxide obviously is being thrown out, because you're going to run. You're going to have to run away from the lion or whatever it might be. And that is what the reaction is all about. It has adrenaline pumped into the bloodstream, and you get this adrenaline in the bloodstream, and you're in front of a computer, and it's the computer that's playing you up, and you're just about to throw the computer out the window, and of course he's got nowhere to go. That's the problem, is that in our modern lifestyle, we've got the fight or flight. We're just about ready to hit the computer, and knowing how much these things cost, we don't do that, and because of that, it builds up and it bottles up inside us, and it comes out in all kinds of problems. I mean, basically, some of the ministers were having fainting fits. They literally just collapsed. And then their breathing would then return to normal. And other ones were having, again, heart fibrillation, same as I was. And there were all kinds of difficulties. There's so many things regarding breath that we don't do these days. I mean, when was the last time you sang? When was the last time you sang for joy? Remember Mr. Armstrong talking about going down the road and hearing the farmer on it behind his plowing behind his horse? I'm singing on the top of his voice. But when do we sing? Oh, you turn on the MP3 player today. And therefore, you can't match the electronically altered sound that you get out of the MP3 player, mind you, you wonder sometimes, you don't go ahead and sing along. And yet, that used to happen all the time. They'd get around the piano and sing. And we don't do that today. So there is a problem with breath, with a problem with breathing. The problem with over-breathing, with hyperventilation, can kill you. So be aware of the breathing problem that is there. And the breath is the life thereof. It's the life thereof. It goes into the blood. The blood is oxygenated. And we've got to make sure that we understand that. Now, one way around that problem with breathing, with over-breathing, with hyperventilation, with dealing with all the stresses and strains of the life that we lead, is exercise. And there's something else we just don't get. We don't tend to get exercise. If you're sitting in front of a computer screen, you don't tend to get exercise. But if you turn back to Genesis 18, now you think, well, oh yes, but I'm in my 70s and I therefore can't exercise. Well, okay, Genesis 18, and the Eternal appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, and Abraham at this time was 99 years old. And as he sat in the tent of the door in the heat of the day, at the heat of the day now, so 99, in the heat of the day, midday, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, three men stood by him, and when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself to the ground. That was Abraham at 99. Now, I'm not suggesting that we say, right, I'm going to run everywhere. Okay, fine, you probably end up with a coronary, but... This is the norm. This is what we should be looking at as the norm. And hopefully in the world tomorrow, when we'll be teaching these things, that's what we need to be thinking of. You see, when we look at the newspapers, the newspaper here, this was from this past week on the 7th, this last Wednesday. Patients refuse treatment. The actual headline was, too fat for NHS surgery, National Health Service surgery. The patients refuse treatment unless they change their lifestyle. And the NHS has been accused of rationing vital treatments after refusing to help undeserving, in quote, patients unless they lose weight or quit smoking. And it goes on, it says, Douglas Carswell, Tory MP for Clacton, said, what people eat or drink or whether they smoke is a lifestyle choice, and it's wrong if it's being management-led. So in other words, that's not the way it should be. Well, in fact, yes, God certainly expects us to go ahead and change. And it certainly makes sense. And in that same paper, incidentally, it says, change your DNA, take some exercise. It says, a few minutes of relatively strenuous exercise can dramatically change a person's DNA, experiments have revealed. The changes affect the chemicals which activate, silence, and crank up genes and their actions. It actually gets into the DNA itself. And alters the genetic formula. Professor Zirath and colleagues from Denmark and Dublin began with two experiments in which healthy men who didn't take exercise regularly were put through their paces on an exercise bike. After they stopped, slivers of muscle were taken from their thigh and the DNA analysed for chemical changes. This revealed that changes occur after just minutes, however gentle exercise won't do. The person needs to be out of breath and while able to speak to have difficulty in carrying on a conversation. So, again, it's the breath. That's what is crucial. And that actually can change the DNA itself. The actual genetic level itself can be changed. But here we see Abraham at 99 years old running, and he also finds in verse 7, it says, and Abraham ran to the herd and fetched a calf tender and true. So again, he would run. He got the exercise. You turn over to 1 Kings. This is the classic one, I think. 1 Kings chapter 18. And in 1 Kings 18, notice in verse 44, here is Elijah. And it came to pass at the seventh time that he said, behold, there arise a little cloud out of the sea, like a man's hand. And he said, go up and say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and get you down, that the rain don't stop you. So he was up on the mountain actually praying, and he told his servant to go and tell Ahab to get in his chariot and then make it back to Samaria. And it came to pass in the meanwhile that the heaven was black with clouds of wind, and there was a great rain, and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And if that was the case, he'd be riding pretty fast. And the hand of the Eternal was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins, and he ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. Now what in fact it was that Ahab would be going with a chariot round the bottom of the mountain, but Elijah was running over the mountain itself and did a short cut across the mountain to get to Jezreel, if you look at the actual topography there. But even so, you try mountain running sometime, and try outrunning a horse going around the outside of a hill. He must have been incredibly fit to have done that. Again, in this stress survival book, it says that the benefits of regular exercise are almost impossible to exaggerate. As well as promoting physical fitness and increasing energy exercise has an immediate effect on anxieties and worries. It's difficult to remain worried, angry or anxious while your mind and body are engaged in physical activity. What I actually did with this problem that I had, we used to go down surfing, frankly, body surfing, down near Newgale, and we would go down there, we'd get wetsuits on, and even, you know, December and January, and people used to look at us thinking we're totally out of our minds, but we'd go body surfing on the weekend. And when you're trying to survive the next wave, and it's, you know, these waves are about 8 foot, some of them 9 foot tall, so it's good sized waves, you go out there from the peak to the trough. It gets your mind completely off the problems of the day. It says, in addition, exercise is an ideal outlet for accumulated tensions, bottled up aggression and frustration, neutralizing mental as well as muscular stress. People who exercise regularly claim that some of the following benefits: improved sleep, fewer headaches, fewer stress-related aches and pains, a greater sense of inner calm, improved mental clarity and concentration, greater physical stamina, and research shows that powerful brain chemicals are released during vigorous exercise. These endorphins, which are morphine-like substances associated with happiness and well-being. And this is why exercise can often dispel negative mental states such as depression or anxiety. So combined together as part of your lifestyle, the right balance of diet and regular exercise can form the basis of a healthy, relaxed and stress-proof life. So, again, there was no problem as far as Abraham was concerned. There was no problem as far as Elijah was concerned. They got enough exercise. They walked everywhere. You find instance, if you put in your notes, we won't turn there, but in Acts 8 verse 30, Philip ran to the chariot, the Ethiopian's chariot. He didn't just walk, he ran. And people did. People, you know, if they needed to run after something, they didn't worry about the coronary, which some people do. They were fit. And unfortunately, in today's world, we do have to worry about the coronary. I'm not suggesting we all run everywhere, but we need to be fitter. We do need to recognise the kind of life that we lead is not natural. Turn over to Luke chapter 13. And, I mean, getting exercise, you think, well, how on earth can I possibly get exercise? Now, if you've got joints, you know, hips that are giving you problems, or knees that are giving you problems, I don't suggest this for a moment. But for the rest of us, you know, something like this, you've got a flight of stairs. You with a handrail at the side, you can hold the handrail. I won't give a demonstration here because they can't watch it on the internet. But you can hold the handrail and you can go leading with your left foot, go onto the first step, then the right foot goes onto the second step. Your left foot joins it onto the second step. Your right foot goes onto the first step, and then your left foot goes onto the the bottom step, and your right foot joins it. And then you lead with your left foot again. And you do that several times, about twice a second, each step twice a second. You will be out of breath within a few seconds. It will not take long, guaranteed. Now, as you do it regularly, so you get out of breath, you can go for longer. But, you know, don't overdo it. But it is such a simple thing. Two steps and a handrail, and you can do that. And you don't have to do it as fast as that. But, you know, for an average person, they can do that. And it will make you increase the blood flow to the point where you'd have difficulty speaking, you know, to holding a conversation. You can gain exercise on something as simple as that. Now, as I say, if you've got bad knees, bad hips, then you've got a problem. You have to do something else. And certainly swimming or something like that often is better. But here in Luke 13, notice in verse 22, it says, "And he went through the cities and the villages, teaching and journeying towards Jerusalem." And so he was going... He was walking through the cities and villages. He was walking all that time. And as he said, verse 33, "Nevertheless, I must walk today and tomorrow and on the day following, for I cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem." So he was up in Samaria in the north, and he was walking probably about, not quite 100 miles, I think, from Samaria down to Jerusalem. I say down. It's not down at all. It's actually up. Samaria is... down towards Galilee, which is below sea level, and you walk up to 3,500 feet above sea level with Jerusalem, and then you drop down to Jericho, which is about 1,000 feet below sea level. Galilee is about on the sea level level. But Christ walked around teaching. I mean, when he went up into a mountain to pray, you see instances of him going up in a mountain to pray. I mean, did he take the chairlift? I mean, it wasn't that way. He didn't take the Snowdonian Railway. He went up there and he walked. And certainly Mr. Armstrong used to walk regularly. Again, in this Integrated Health Bible, the book's called, it says, "Of course, there are many other excellent forms of exercise, and I'd like to say a few words about walking. One of my regular projects is to take patients on walking trips in the Himalayas." I'm not suggesting that you do that necessarily, but that is walking and a half. It says, "Many have been seriously ill with chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, nervous disorders, various stages of paralysis, bereavement, and so on. Mainly they suffer from severe stress-related illnesses. The transformation during 2 weeks of trekking is astounding. They can all walk, young or old, however sick, and so can you. And here are some of the benefits of walking. It helps to improve blood circulation. It helps to restore joint mobility. It reduces joint pain. Toxins are eliminated through perspiration. The brain gets fresh oxygen. The digestion is improved. Lung capacity and function are improved. It improves posture. It dispels feeling of tiredness and lethargy. Walking on green grass even improves eyesight. It restores the body's equilibrium, it helps reduce weight, it reduces high blood pressure, it improves the skin condition, it reduces stress and tension, and it has a beneficial effect on diabetes. And I'll second that as well. My father had type 2 diabetes towards the end of his life, and he used to find that because we had a haulage business, and he was collecting the 10-gallon churns of milk from the farms, and he would deliberately have a milk run, or he deliberately just to get the exercise. So he'd get out at about 4 o'clock in the morning and he'd be finished by about 9. But he was much better doing that. And the diabetes, he didn't need to... He'd be able to eat more to compensate without any problem. He felt fitter as a result of it. So beneficial effect on diabetes. And like yoga, it has no age limit. One of the reasons villagers are more healthy than urban dwellers is that they walk a lot. So get out there and walk, walk, walk. So it is something, again... It depends. You've got to be careful if you've got joint problems, severe joint problems, but walking is something that all of us should be doing, quite frankly. We were designed to walk. We're designed to walk. I mean, we walk down to the mile or so, down to the village, shop and back each day. We deliberately have a paper so that we have to walk down to the shop to pick it up. Otherwise, we can so easily sit in front of the computer screen from dawn to dusk. And this business about the steps at the bottom of the stairs, because when I go downstairs, I try, if I remember, to do a few rounds of around the first and second step to try and get the blood moving again before I plonk myself in front of the computer yet again. Because if we don't do that, where do we get the exercise? How can you build it in? And Mr. Armstrong certainly walked. He would walk regularly around the campus. And that is one thing. Well into his 80s and 90s, he would walk. And that's he did. Mr. Armstrong did get the exercise. He did believe in that, and he actually lived that kind of life. And so should we. And we need to teach that in the future. Now, I don't think in the future there's going to be a problem with exercise, the same as there wasn't in times gone past. In fact, when we talk to people about exercise in the future, think, what do you mean exercise? What's this exercise bit? Probably think of the games or whatever. Now, what about sleep? Here's an article from the Daily Mail. I'm not sure when it was. I think it was just last month, about a month ago. It says, not sleeping enough can damage your immune system and make you ill, says a study. Regularly staying up late or having a disrupted sleep pattern leaves us open to infection and illness, according to new research. Our immune system is linked to our sleep cycle and will be damaged if regular sleep patterns are disturbed. Researchers have found that the circadian clock, the genetic mechanism which regulates our sleep, controls the level of a gene vital for our immune system also. So if we do have a problem sleeping, or I'm not saying a problem sleeping is very difficult to put right, but deliberately staying up late and not getting the rest, that's different. And we should be aware that it's not the case that we should never stay up late, that we shouldn't go ahead and sometimes even go right through the night, as I'll go on and show you. Christ did that. He stayed awake right through the night, but not night after night after night. That's the problem. That's where it gets a problem. And when we look at these instances, there's another one here from Telegraph. It says breast cancer risk on night shifts. It says women who work night shifts could be increasing their risk of breast cancer, a study suggests. Scientists have found evidence that exposure to light at night confuses the body clock and interferes with the normal production of the hormone melatonin. Extremely low levels of melatonin, a natural chemical that regulate the daily sleep-wake cycle, have been linked to tumour growth. So, you know, it is serious. It is not just a case of not feeling very good the next following day. We should make sure that we do the best we can to get sufficient sleep. Another one, this is from the Daily Telegraph again, shortage of sleep linked to obesity. The less you sleep, the more your waist will expand, say scientists who have linked insomniac lifestyles of Western society to the epidemic of obesity. So it's not just a case of more food. It's the more food plus less sleep that seems to do it. Lack of sleep boosts levels of a hormone that triggers appetite and lowers levels of a hormone that tells your body is full, according to this team. The scientists will now study whether obese people should sleep more to lose weight. And the study by this certain professor and the University of Bristol and colleagues is published today in the Public Library of Science. Our results demonstrate an important relationship between sleep and metabolic hormones, the team reports. In Western societies, where chronic sleep restriction is common and food is widely available, changes in appetite regulation in hormones with sleep curtailment may contribute to obesity. So it is important that... We do, and certainly I know that my wife has a problem with sleeping, and the thing that really kicked it out was trying to survive in, you know, going between countries, jet lag, and then once you land, you've got to survive day in and day out using coffee to as stimulants, and that really has caused a problem. We just got to be careful, and she has got to be careful to make sure her sleep patterns are what they should be. But over here in Luke chapter 8, let's turn over to Luke chapter 8. Be aware that it says in verse 22, it says, now it came to pass on a certain day that he went into a ship with his disciples, and he said to them, let's go over to the other side of the lake. And they launched forth, but as they sailed, he fell asleep. Now, if you notice, and we'll go and read something that had been taking place around that time, the reason why he probably fell asleep is because he had been missing sleep. But it's not wrong to miss sleep on occasions, but then you've got to catch up. Again, remember, Christ lived a life which was a perfect life, both spiritually and physically as well. It's not that God expected... We haven't been made to require 8 hours sleep every single night, come without fail. If we miss 8 hours one night, we're therefore sinning physically. That's not the way it works. But if we miss night after night after night and we deprive ourselves of sleep, then yes, we are. We're going in the wrong direction. As they sailed, he fell asleep, and there came down a storm of wind on the lake, and they were filled with water, and they were in jeopardy. And they came to him and woke him, saying, Master, Master, we perish. And he rose and rebuked the wind and the raging sea and the water, and they ceased, and there was a calm. So we can see him being able to sleep on a sixpence, in that sense, being able to just bed down in the front of the boat as the thing was being tossed and wherever he was bedded down at the time. If we turn back a couple of pages to Luke chapter 6, and notice it says in verse 12, and it came to pass in those days that he went out into a mountain to pray, and he continued all night in prayer to God. So he prayed all night, and when it was day, he called to him his disciples, and when he chose 12, of whom he named apostles. So that's what he was praying about. This was an important, vital time in his life, and he chose to go ahead and spend all night in prayer, because it was so vital that he get the right choice. And that was not just the choice of those that would be apostles that would take the truth into the world in the future. It was also the choice of Judas Iscariot as well. He was also making sure that he got the right individual for that particular role. So he had to choose all 12. And he prayed all night before choosing those apostles. So it's not wrong to do that. There's an article here from the BBC News, and again, this was just recently in the last couple of weeks. It says, the myth of the 8-hour sleep. It says, we often worry about lying awake in the middle of the night, but it could be good for you. A growing body of evidence from both science and history suggests that an 8-hour sleep may actually be unnatural. In other words, do we actually need 8 hours in one stretch? It says, in the early 1990s, psychiatrist Thomas Ware conducted an experiment in which a group of people were plunged into darkness. And also at the same time, somebody did some research in days gone by, and they found that what actually happened was that there's a clear record of two sleeps, of sleeping for 4 hours and then waking. Remember, again, we live in an unnatural time today. These lights that we've got here on here, they didn't have that in days gone by. So you come sunset, certainly in the Middle East, come sunset, they'd go to bed. Now, you wouldn't need the entire time in bed. It's 12 hours or more. You don't need 12 hours sleep. So come sunset, you might light a candle or something initially, and then you get to bed early, basically. And you sleep for 4 hours, and then they'd awake. And many times, again, you read the Psalms, in the night watches it talks about. And they would lie awake, and they would pray. They would think, they'd meditate. It would be a time of reflection. And they'd even get up and maybe, talk or whatever. Then they'd go back for another 4 hours afterwards. And that certainly certainly indicates that we don't need 8 hours at a stretch necessarily. Now, if you can get 8 hours at a stretch, if you can get 7 hours at a stretch, that's fine. But that's not the way it certainly used to be. And looking here in what Christ's life is concerned, where he was able to stay up all day, but then he went ahead and he slept in the front of a boat. So he was able to snatch his sleep. And it wasn't breaking God's laws of health. It wasn't breaking God's laws of health. But had he done it night after night after night, yes, it would, because the immune system is affected by that. The immune system is affected by this sleep-deprived lifestyle that we have today, where we're in front of a computer all the time, where our lights are on all the time, where we plug ourselves in front of a television set all the time, and therefore we're getting constant light, which upsets the circadian rhythm and causes problems for us. Now, if we turn back to Ecclesiastes 5, again, the advantage of exercise is even there within sleep as well. And it says in verse 10, it says, he that loves silver is not going to be satisfied with silver, nor he that loves abundance with increase. This also is his vanity. Where goods increase, there increase that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, except beholding them with the eyes? But the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not allow him to sleep. So we need to make sure we understand that it's not just exercise, it's labouring, it's having even the joy of working hard and bringing in money. I know when I used to, I had a hamburger store at one particular time, and one of the best times of the day was when you actually came back at night, when you counted the money, that's what it was, and you actually figured out how much you made. And actually having your hands on the money itself, there's something very therapeutic about it, it really was. And so this, the sleep of a labouring man, when he comes back and he's got his money in his hand, he's laboured all day, there's also that completeness, that mental completeness as well, that is occurring, as well as the exercise that he's got. So it's both. It's a double whammy in that sense. But turn over to Matthew 11. Matthew 11. We need to be aware of this as well. Because many of us do suffer from insomnia from time to time. Some of us have real problems with it. And be aware of what it actually says here in Matthew 11, verse 28. It says, "Come to me, all you that labour and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest." Now, the rest is spiritual rest, yes it is, but it also physically as well. We can put all our cares upon him, for he cares for us. You know, we don't have to worry and fret, but what we do so often is we put our cares upon him and in our prayers, and then we put them back on our shoulders and we wander out the door with them. And that's the problem. That is a problem. Once we put our prayer cares upon him, then we leave them there and we go forward, looking forward. And it says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." For your physical bodies. "For my yoke is easy, my burden is light." Because you can leave the problems there. Therefore you move forward and you don't have the yoke anymore. The yoke is actually left under the blood of Christ. The yoke that you have then is obedience to God's law, is obedience to the way of God, the mind of God, having to develop that mind. And that is a lighter burden because you don't have the kickbacks. So we should be aware of that, the fact that sleep is a vital part of life, and one way we can make sure that we mentally get to the point. I mean, there's all kinds of techniques. You can read the books and see the techniques of, having a boring book at bedtime, basically, which we try and do, something along those lines, something almost mindless that is, you know, obviously, it's got to be kosher, but you read this boring book at bedtime that then helps you to get into the frame of mind of sleeping. You go through this routine. My routine is to go around and check the doors and to check the windows and to brush my teeth. And there's the routine that's got to be set. And the only problem is the door handles are actually wearing out now because they get checked so often. But relaxation is another skill that we seem to be losing. Mark chapter 6. Turn over to Mark chapter 6. And it's difficult at times to get the balance right in today's society because, again, we can switch a light on. When we were on the dig in Jerusalem, we would find all these little oil lamps in the dig because they were used. That was what they used. They had olive oil in them, little tiny ones. They're only about 3 inches long, something like that. Almost round, and there's a hole in the top that for the reservoir. And there's like a little Aladdin's lamp spout where the wick would actually go in. And so you'd top it into the middle, the centre hole, and the wick would then burn the oil. And that's all they used to have. That was their light. That was what they used to use. But they didn't just go into a house and flick on a switch. They had to light the light. And quite frankly, to do any kind of study and reading, and again, they wouldn't have had books that we had, let alone televisions and computers and everything else. But this lifestyle is having a problem with our relaxation. And Mark chapter 6, verse 30 says, "The apostles gathered themselves together to Jesus and told him all the things, both what they'd done and what they'd taught. And he said to them, 'Come you yourselves apart to a desert place.'" And the word desert here isn't desert in the sense of being dry. It's desert in the sense of being deserted. and whether it was dry or not, it probably had some trees. It probably was fairly dry, but it was a deserted place. And rest a while, for there's many coming and going, and there's no leisure as so much as to eat. So they were so busy at that particular juncture. And they departed to a desert place by ship privately. And the people saw them departing, and many knew him, and they ran afoot hither to all cities, and out went them, and came together to him. And they then find, verse 34, and Jesus, when he came out, they saw the much people, and he was moved with compassion towards them, because they were a sheep not having a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. So his idea of the relaxation was that, no, he wasn't able to do it at that time. Okay, fine, he made his life, bend his life to serve the people that he had there, and made up for things later on. Notice in verse 45, it says, and straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. So he therefore stayed behind, and he sent the people away. And when he had sent them away, he then departed to a mountain to pray. How did he depart? Did he get the cable car? No, he didn't. He walked. He walked up into the mountain. And while he was there, you know, maybe walked for half an hour or more, and then he came to a certain spot, and in the still of the night, and again, presumably there would be a moon or something so he could see what he was doing. Again, we lose sight of this in the modern world. In the modern world, the moon is immaterial, whether the moon's out, whether the moon's not. You come and live in the countryside and see whether it's immaterial or not. I remember trying to go back one time from a local farmer about, three quarters of a mile away from our home. And I misjudged it. I'd been actually working on helping him apply paint on the front of his house. And he invited me in for a drink, and then I went, it became dark. And I came out, and it was pitch black. And to try and get out of that, and the hedges were about, they hadn't been trimmed, and they were about, 10 foot tall or whatever, either side of this narrow little road. And I could not see. I was literally having to feel my way through, back up to the main road, and back home again. And again, without that parish lantern, the moon, then you really do miss it. You really do. But he went and sent them away. He departed to a mountain to pray. And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he alone on the land. So he went up, and he made sure he had the time available to pray. Because that's what he said. He said, look, it's been so busy. We need to go somewhere quiet and just get away from it all. And that's what he did. That's what he tried to do, and yet people followed him. So what did he do? He then taught them out of compassion. He then worked with them, and he sent them away. He sent his disciples away, and he went up in the mountain to pray. He managed to make sure he got his priorities sorted. But he obviously missed out on some sleep. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was that he was so busy that the spiritual areas of his life were not in keeping as they should have been. And here, coming from this book of stress survival again, it says, relaxation is the most natural activity in the world. Animals retain an inbuilt capacity for alternating periods of physical tension with regular states of relaxation in a way that we humans have long forgotten. Look at the way a cat stretches its limbs or sensuously arches its back. You know, you put a cat in front of the fire, and it could be in front of the fire all winter long. And then come the spring and it's outside, it looks as if it's been fit as a flea. Why? Because every time it gets up, it arches its back, it stretches. If you want to know how to tell if an animal is sick, watch the animal as it gets up from lying down. If that animal doesn't stretch, it's ill. If it stretches, the chances are it's well. And that is, it's a sign that anybody who's a farmer who basically goes and watches the animals, you know, you see these farmers watching their animals over the farm gate, and you think, well, what a waste of time. Well, it's not a waste of time at all. You're looking for something, maybe not walking properly because you've got some foot rot in the claw of its foot, or when it gets up and it doesn't stretch. But stretching is what animals do. And we should. You know, if we get up in the morning and we stretch, then the chances are we're fit. If we get up in the morning and just kind of stumble into the day, the chances are we're not fit. There is something wrong. And we need to be aware of that. The relaxation, he says, look at the way the cat stretches his limbs or sensuously arches his back. How a dog yawns and flops on its back, its paws hanging loose. We have a lot to learn from the way animals release pent-up tension from their bodies to ease themselves into action. Why should we treat our own bodies with any less sense of sensibility? Yet relaxation is a forgotten art. Few people today could claim to be completely relaxed for most of their waking hours. It says something about the degree of stress in our lives and the amount of unconscious or hidden tension in our bodies that we need to learn and relearn and practice the art of relaxation in order to safeguard our well-being. This should be natural. It should be natural that we should be able to relax, but we so often we don't. We're uptight all the time. It says, many people do not realize how unrelaxed they really are. If you have started to ignore the buildup of strain and tension in your limbs, joints and muscles, and fail to diffuse these physical stresses when they begin to affect your mind and body, you will gradually begin to store that tension in various parts of your body. You'll be carrying tension around with you whatever you do. Allowing hidden tension to increase and take hold of your body will inevitably affect the way you feel and how you function, since a tense body is less efficient and well coordinated than a relaxed one. You'll also start to feel the physical effects of stress, and on it goes. I mean, you know, if you get a headache, you check your neck, check your shoulders, because if those shoulders are tight, something clamps around the neck. I've noticed myself that something clamps around the back of the neck and stops the flow, presumably it must be lymph, and it affects the head, it affects the sinuses, it gives you a headache. You release that, you get rid of that, you try to twist the neck and just exercise that or get somebody to massage it, and not only will the headache go, the nose will start to run as well. And so there's, again, we're fearfully and wonderfully made. But as far as Christ was concerned, he knew the need for relaxation. They knew the need to get away from it all, to pray, yes, certainly. But more than that, we were actually made to have relaxation. Turn back to Genesis 2. In Genesis 2, we find that same being, Jesus Christ, implementing something that was necessary for mankind. In Genesis 2 verse 1, the heavens and the earth were finished and the hosts of them, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he'd made, and he rested, his Shabbat, he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had made. Now he didn't need to rest, and it says that God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, set it apart, because in it he rested, he Shabbated, from all the work which God created and made. And the Sabbath is, the word Sabbath means rest. That's where it comes from. It comes from this word, rested, Shabbat. And it's actually part of the very creation itself. And you see, in the creation, the way in which Christ worked, he did it, he operated a day at a time. A day he did something, and then he looked back on the work that he was doing when the evening came, and he saw that it was good. And then he began the next day, evening and morning, and he looked back on the day's activity of that day, and he saw it was good. And he gives us a yardstick on which how we should be working. That we should be working in such a way, you start in the evening before, you plan the day, you work through the day, you come to the end of the day, and you look back on what you've done with accomplishment. And then you start the next day in the evening. And you plan the day, and you go into the next day, and so on. And you do that for 6 days, and the seventh day is the Sabbath of rest, which is what the word Sabbath means. And it's a cycle that has been given to us as far as relaxation is concerned. Mr. Armstrong himself mentioned in a personal back in April 1980 in the Good News. It says that, on the other hand, it said God made the Sabbath to be a time of joy, of delight, of rest, prayer, contemplation, Bible study and worship. As we read about Christ, going to get away from it all. Well, the Sabbath is to be that. It says, when I was 19 years of age, I was a timekeeper and paymaster in southern Mississippi lumber mill. I had to do the job 3 men had been required to do before I came. I worked one night until 10, the next night till midnight, 6 days a night, and nights a week. I was overworked, and in 6 months I landed in the hospital with a severe case of typhoid fever. To just lie there in bed and rest was so delightful after the 6 month stint of 18 hours a day labour. I realised as never before how delightful rest from work can be. And Mr. Armstrong had to learn that as a young boy, but do we? Do we learn it? Or are we burning the candle at both ends? Are we trying to live a life that, which is a modern lifestyle, using the lights that we've got, we're not getting the right amount of rest, and we're not getting the right amount of relaxation as well. Now, some people get too much relaxation. That's another problem. But regarding hygiene, when we come onto the subject of hygiene, it's the same way. Some people get too much hygiene. In other words, everything is always sterile. They go around with Dettol and spraying all the surfaces. And that really is not the way we're designed to live. That is not the way we're designed to live at all. We are designed to actually drink unpasteurized milk if we can. But it's got to be unpasteurized milk from healthy cows or healthy goats, healthy animals. If you're going to have the kind of cows and animals that we've got today, it's better to have the stuff pasteurized, quite frankly, because the animals are not healthy. But if you've got a healthy animal, you're looking after the health of that animal, then unpasteurized milk is the way to go, and unpasteurized cheeses and so on. But that's not what we get today because of the food industry. But we're going to have to teach hygiene in the millennium. Can we? Do we understand what the principles of hygiene are as far as God is concerned? You know, when we think about what's going to happen in the future, the entire structure of the world is going to be broken down. The entire structure will lie in ruins. Now, we don't have to go back that long. Let me read this. It comes from an article on health and hygiene in the 19th century. It says, in his report on the sanitary conditions of the labouring population of Great Britain, Edwin Chadwick included figures to show that in 1839, notice, in 1839, which isn't that long ago, it's less than 200 years ago, for every person who died of old age or violence, 8 died of specific diseases. And these were, you know, things like diphtheria and cholera and that kind of thing. This helps explain that why during the second and third decades of the 19th century, nearly one infant in 3 in England failed to reach the age of 5. 1 in 3 didn't get to the age of 5. And they actually wouldn't name the child. They wouldn't name the child until the sometimes until their 5th birthday, because they didn't know if they're going to be survive or not. It was literally that rough. So the situation is going to be broken down. I always remember that Dr. Stewart, who taught, it was hygiene, wasn't it? Nutrition and hygiene in college. It was actually a class, nutrition and hygiene together. But he always had the phrase, he said, if you've got somebody who's got diarrhea and the runs and that kind of thing, there's basically one problem that has caused it. And he says, dirty human feces, he says. And that basically is the problem, and that's what you find. Now, that's not strictly 100% true, because you get things like salmonella that will cause problems in the eggs, undercooked eggs and undercooked meat. That's why I say in the church, in the church potlucks and so on, I want meat, I want eggs cooked thoroughly, and because I don't want people coming down with salmonella or whatever. But the main problem is that the bacteria from the body get into water supplies, the bacteria from the body get into food supplies, and there are means and ways to actually stop that from actually happening. And you might think, well, we don't have that today. Well, yes, you do have that today. I remember one time being looking after a church, the feast down in an African country, and having to deal with a particular problem. Well, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 23, because this is the verse I had to turn to, because the individuals, it was the young children. It wasn't the older children, it was the younger children. That literally were not used to flush toilets. They'd never seen one before. Didn't know how to use one. And I had to encourage the parents to to make sure that the children use those toilets because they were defecating at the sides of various paths, which, you know, was, as it says here in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and in verse 12, it says, "You shall have a place also outside the camp where you shall go forth abroad." Now, in modern times, with a flush toilet, it gets flushed and it gets taken outside the dwelling place, outside the camp, into a septic tank or septic pit. "And you shall have a paddle on your weapon, and it shall be when you will ease yourself abroad that you shall dig therewith, and shall turn back and cover that which comes from you. For the Eternal your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give you up your enemies before you. Therefore shall your camp be holy." And the word holy carries the connotation of being clean. And it says that he sees no unclean thing in you and turn away from you. You know, the Eternal is holy, therefore you shall be holy. It carries the connotation, the Eternal is clean. We, therefore, need to be clean. And regarding the cleanliness, and just be aware of something, that the gut, we think, well, why did God make it that way? Well, basically, the actual bacteria in the gut. We are flesh and blood, and the dirt that we are is both inside and out. In other words, the entire alimentary canal is so filled with bacteria. Let me just read something I wrote the other day. This is coming from a Healthspan magazine. They're trying to sell their probiotics and their supplements and everything else like this. So there's a reason for them giving the various bits of information, but this is a doctor writing in this particular one, the role of probiotics. It says, "Your bowels contain around 11 trillion bacteria, more than the total number of human cells in your body. It's actually 10 times the number of human cells in your body. Together, these bacteria weigh around 1.5 kilo. So that's what? That's 3-4 pounds, old money. So something around about 4 pounds. Bowel bacteria play an important role in intestinal health. Now that's just the bacteria, the weight of the bacteria now. They ferment fibre and bulk up the stools and make defecation easier. In fact, every 1 gram in dietary fibre that you consume increases the weight of your motions by about 5 grams, mostly due to the increased weight of bacteria. So the fibre that you eat is multiplied fivefold by the bacteria feeding on it. And that, you know, with the minerals and everything else that's in there. Ideally, at least 70% of the bowel bacteria should be probiotic, which by definition provide definable health benefits. Only 30% should be other types of bacteria, such as E. coli, which tend to produce gas and can in certain circumstances produce harmful toxins. But just be aware of the volume of bacteria that are there. And this is why when it says here that when you have that camp, you have a place outside the camp, you go abroad and you turn over and you get rid of that, because it is laden, absolutely laden with bacteria. And it's designed that way. It says, "Because our bowel empties regularly, probiotic bacteria are readily lost from the body along with the less desirable relatives. Replenishment comes from those adhering to the gut wall and, notice this, and from the vermiform appendix." The appendix, in other words, is a purpose for it. "A blind pouch which acts as a reservoir for bacteria. When we are under stress following a poor diet or taking antibiotics, however, our numbers of probiotic bacteria dwindle, and this can lead to an imbalance known as dysbiosis. Lack of probiotic bacteria increases the risk of a number of digestive problems." And of course, they're pushing their probiotic pills by saying that. But I thought it was interesting that the appendix is something that they now have discovered, oh, it's got a use after all. Let me read what it says in the Wikipedia about the appendix. It says, "William Parker, Randy Bollinger and colleagues at Duke University proposed that the appendix serves as a haven for useful bacteria when illness flushes those bacteria from the rest of the intestines." So when you have the runs, the body flushes all the harmful bacteria out, but in the appendix, there are the bacteria that then replenish the gut. Now, you kill them all with antibiotics, then you've got to replenish it some way by using a probiotic. This proposal is based on new understanding of how the immune system supports the growth of beneficial intestinal bacteria. In combination with many well-known features of the appendix, including its architecture, its location just below the normal one-way flow of food, and germs in the large intestine and its association with copious amount of immune tissue, research performed at Winthrop University Hospital shows that the individuals without an appendix were, and notice this, 4 times more likely to have a recurrence of Clostridium difficile. Now, that's one of these superbugs. So the appendix actually helps to combat that. It helps to, somebody has had the appendix removed, then there is a problem with that. We're not meant to have our appendix removed. But if we're looking at hygiene, cross-contamination is essential. Latrines outside the camp was one area. In other words, you don't get the bacteria that are meant to stay in the gut or be disposed of properly that then get cross-contaminated into the food supply. That again is something that we would need to look at. If you turn it over to Leviticus chapter 7, and in verse 19, it says, "And the flesh that touches any unclean thing shall not be eaten. It shall be burnt with fire, and as for the flesh, all that they be clean shall eat thereof." In other words, we're not to eat something if defiled. If it's been defiled by something that comes out of somebody's body, for instance, then it's, or a fly, if you like, lands on it, quite frankly, and it's covered with flies. It shouldn't be eaten. This is after the sacrifice has been cooked. So avoiding cross-contamination is essential. And dishcloths, again, we need to be careful with dishcloths. If you've got dishcloths, they need to be cleaned regularly. Because I think they did swabs one time of a dishcloth. I did swabs of a toilet seat, and they found more bugs on the dishcloth than they did on the toilet seat. So be aware that it does need to be looked after properly. And I'll come on to how to be looked after properly. It's not just washing, it's drying as well. It's not just washing by itself. Animals in kitchens are not a good idea. I remember going to people's places sometimes, the cats walking along the tops of the countertops, I'm afraid. Any cat that did that in my house got flying lessons, and it's the way it works. Our dogs were kept in the back parlour, in the back kitchen area, away from the kitchen. But you know, fingernails and children and so on. You just be aware. You know, they need to wash their hands and avoid the cross contamination. And here in Leviticus 7, verse 15. It says, "And the flesh of the sacrifice of the peace offering for thanksgiving will be eaten the same day as it's offered, and they shall not leave it any of it till the morning. But the sacrifice of the offering is a vow, a voluntary offering. It shall be eaten the same day the offers the sacrifice, and in the morning shall the remainder of it be eaten. But the remainder of the flesh of the sacrifice on the third day shall be burnt with fire. If any of the flesh then remains, it's then discounted as far as an offering is concerned." So 2 days maximum was food was, the offerings were concerned. And today, what is the kind of principles involved is to make sure that we have the correct temperatures in our fridges, in our freezers and so on. Because otherwise, if you just leave something out in room temperature, it will go bad. It'll go off. We need to make sure that the temperatures are maintained. The way in which things are cleaned up, turn over to Leviticus 11. It says in verse 29, "These shall be unclean to you among the creeping things that creep upon the earth, the weasel, the mouse, the tortoise after his kind, the ferret, the chameleon, the lizard, and the snail, and the mole. These are unclean to you among all that creep. Whatever does touch them, notice, when they are dead, they will be unclean until the even. And upon whatsoever any of them, when they're dead, does fall, it shall be unclean, whether it's any vessel of wood, or raiment, or skin, or sack. Whatever vessel it is, or work's done, it must be put into water, and it shall be unclean until the even, and then it'll be cleansed. So what do? You take something, you wash it, you put it down somewhere, and you let it dry. And what happens then is the bacteria and the bugs that are on there go into a different state. They go into a dormant state, and they actually get blown off the surface. I mean, anybody that has worked in a dairy knows what milk practice is. I mean, milk practice, you basically wash your utensils in cold water to start off with. So it washes all the fat particles off the milk, off the container, the bucket, or whatever it is. So you wash it in cold water thoroughly. Then you wash it with really scalding hot detergent water, which then removes anything else that's there. Then you wash it with scalding hot, clean water, and then you turn it upside down, and you leave it. And there you have the same kind of thing being mentioned here, where you wash it and you dry it, and it's air dried. You don't get a cloth, you don't need a dishcloth, and then wipe it inside, because that then adds the bugs back in there again. But the washing of hands, here in Leviticus, notice... Well, we'll come on to that in a little while, about the washing of hands. Very quickly then, quarantine. Let me just read to you, first of all, from the Pastor General's report of June the 4th, 1982. Now, this is when Mr. Armstrong was trying to get the church back on track, and it's reminders about sick children. It's good to again remind the brethren about not... This is Pastor General's report. This was written to the ministry and how they're to handle sick children. Again, remind the brethren about not bringing their children to church services or church functions if they are ill. Children with a bad cough or cold, measles, chickenpox, whooping cough, etc., should under no circumstances be brought in contact with other children. Now, you find in schools that they will actually... We've had the cases where we were furious that a teacher was allowing the children back into schools with chickenpox. Robin got the chickenpox from that experiment, and then we had to go up to SEP to work in SEP, and he had to be quarantined. He was in a caravan van by himself off the side of the camp there for a certain amount of time. Any parent whose child has been in contact with another child who is later found to have measles should place their child in quarantine for at least 14 days. Now notice that date, that timing, 14 days, because we'll just read something in Leviticus if we've got time, to be certain whether or not he or she has contracted the disease. Any minister who notices a child at services or at other church-related functions with what appears to be a contagious illness should immediately ask the parents to take the child home. The basic underlying principle, and it also goes for adults that are ill as well, it's not just children. The basic underlying principle involved here is one of showing love to one another, certainly what God would expect of his people. So that was the announcement, or that was the ministerial advice that came in the PGR back in June 1982. Here in Leviticus, if we read a little bit more about... if we turn to here in Leviticus 13, notice in verse 8, let's hit some of the high points regarding the spreading phase where we're looking at leprosy. And it says... leprosy, by the way, it doesn't mean... the leprosy that we know. It includes that, but it means any real skin transfiguring skin disease. So chickenpox probably would come under this, although it was the real leprosy that they were really going for. And if the priests see that, behold, the scab spreads in the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a leprosy. So if it's a spreading phase, they are to leave them, you know, they're unclean. They're to be dealt with as unclean. Notice in verse 10, and the priest shall see him, and behold, if the rising be white in the skin, and if he has turned the hair white, and there be quick raw flesh in the rising, then it's an old leprosy, and they shall shut. Not sure, he's unclean, basically. And verse 14, but when the raw flesh appears in him, he shall be unclean. So it's an active phase. When you've got raw weeping sores and so on, they're unclean. And remember, we are going to have to teach this in the future. In the millennium, you're going to have to deal with this kind of thing in the initial time of the millennium. Verse 45, Notice what they used to have to do. And the leper in whom the plague is, his clothes shall be torn, his head bare, and he'll put a covering upon his upper lip and shall cry, unclean, unclean. In other words, he keeps away from other people and he covers his mouth so he doesn't spread his germs, doesn't sneeze over everyone. So unclean, basically, until they're well. Now, the isolation here in Leviticus 13, notice in verse 4, it says, in the bright spot be white in the skin of his flesh, and indeed not deeper than the skin, and the hair not turned white. And the priest shall shut him up, that he has the plague, 7 days. And the priest shall look upon him on the seventh day, and behold, if the plague in his sight is a stay, or the plague has not spread in the skin, then the priest shall shut him up another 7 days. And then, if it hasn't spread, he is clean. And I want you to notice that the instruction regarding measles was at least 14 days. There's the reason why. 14 days. And you check, meanwhile, between the two stages. But once you're over the infectious stage, notice in verse 12, it says, and if the leprosy break out abroad in the skin, and the leprosy cover all over the skin of him that has the plague, from his head to his foot, wherever the priest looks, and the priest shall consider, and behold, if the leprosy has covered all his flesh, he'll pronounce him clean. Okay? So it looks as if he's got it all top to bottom, top to toe, but notice it says, it is all turned white, he's clean, but when raw flesh appears in him, he'll be unclean. So he may have the residue spots, say, of chicken pox, but they're all over him, but they're not weeping sores. He's not a weeping sore anymore. He's therefore clean, even though he's got the scars. But it's only the scars that are there. And this is what happened. I mean, 6 days after the spots appeared, apparently, with chicken pox, they ceased to be infectious with other children. But you've still got spots all over. Notice in chapter 15, just very quickly now, chapter 15, it says about speaking to the children of Israel, verse 2, and say to them, when any man has a running issue out of his flesh, in other words, he's got the runs, basically, and this shall be his uncleanness of his issue, he runs with his issue, it's his uncleanness. And verse 11, and whoever he touches that has the issue and has not rinsed his hands in water. So in other words, if you've got the runs, you basically make meticulous care to wash your hands and don't touch anybody or anything. And quite frankly, personal quarantine, it needs to be done regarding all of us. We need to wash our hands, and in certain circumstances like that, we don't handle food. We don't allow ourselves to handle food. We get somebody else to do it. And final scripture in this series of All Being Well, chapter 14, notice verse 1. Because the priest was actually to go off the camp and assess this. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, this is the law of the leper in the day of his cleansing. He shall be brought to the priest. And the priest shall go forth out of the camp. And the priest shall look and behold if the plague of leprosy is healed in the leper. But the priest went outside the camp. He didn't bring the leper into the camp. He didn't bring it was quarantined. And I think the word quarantine, as far as I remember, it comes from the Italian for 40. Or Spanish for 40, basically. They used to have 40 days that a ship coming into the ports would have to remain at anchor during the time of the plague before they'd be allowed to disembark. And that was the quarantine. It's a time of the 40 days because they recognised that by that time they could then see whether in fact the ship had the plague or they didn't have the plague and they didn't want it to come onto their city. So that's the final sermon on the series of health and healing. Healing, remember, is the forgiveness of sin, and we'll certainly be considering that on the night of the Passover. It's not avoiding the penalty, it's the fact that Christ took that penalty on himself. But it does involve the degree of physical repentance that is necessary, that we get ourselves aligned. And it's a holistic subject, to align ourselves overall with a healthy lifestyle. It's not that we're going to have everything perfect. We can't. In today's society, that's simply not possible. But our mind needs to be concentrated on the positive things And mind does affect our gut, it affects our heart, our bones, and so on. The food, again, is based on vegetables, so I mentioned that's the basis, the foundation. But the industrial consumer industry has made everybody consumers, and instead of sons of God. But as we've gone through today, the breathing and exercise, the sleep, the relaxation, the hygiene and the quarantine, if we put all these things into place, it is important. We do, in fact, reflect God's mind on that. But the physical body is not going to last. It's not the thing that's going to survive into the future. You know, the physical is merely a type of the spiritual, and it's therefore the more important areas that we need to be examining. And that's what we intend to do then between now and Passover.